now is 15:40 on the 27th. We have two bills before us today.
Billion time, what is that?
That's Matt Sue for about 20 minutes till 4.
Okay.
Today, we have two bills before us, Senate Bill 214, hunting by members of the military, and Senate Bill 246, which we've heard previously, the Susitna Hydro. And first, we will hear Senate Bill 214 and Ms. Jody Simpson of Big Lake, Almost Peerless. Welcome. Can you put yourself on the record?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Jody Simpson, and I am staff to Senator Huggins. Before you this afternoon for your consideration is Senate Bill 214, which pertains to hunting for members of the military and their dependents. As you can see from the Ledge Research report in your packet, the majority of states have unique licensing statutes for active duty military personnel. At least 45 offer resident license rates without regard to actual residency status to active duty personnel or personnel stationed in that state. 8 of those states, including Alaska, require personnel to be stationed in a state for a specific period of time, most 60 to 90 days. At 12 months, Alaska's waiting period is by far the longest among the states. Because military personnel are transferred around the world, often without having any real say in where they're stationed, they are not similarly situated to others who choose to move to Alaska voluntarily. The fact that transfers are involuntary and frequent means that they may be unable to establish qualifications for normal residency and ever be able to take advantage of state residents' preferences. If Senate Bill 214 is enacted, it will provide benefits to active duty members and their dependents by waiving that 12-month waiting period. Current statute AS 16.05340D entitles non-resident military members stationed in Alaska to special military licenses at the resident rate for sport fishing and small game hunting. So this bill does not deal with those two categories. However, that provision does not extend to big game licenses and tags. If military members who have not reached that residency status want to go big game hunting, they must now purchase big game licenses at the non-residential rate, plus big game tags at one-half the non-resident rate. Senate Bill 214, if enacted, would allow them to purchase both big game licenses and tags at that resident rate. An example of the current hunting fees would be if you wanted to go grizzly bear hunting, you'd need a big game hunting tag. It would cost a resident $25, a member of the military who is a resident $250, and a non-resident $500. So there is a disparity, a spectrum there for fee structure. I'd like to draw your attention to several items about the bill before you. First, the Department of Fish and Game indicated that there would be a fiscal impact to their department of about $31,000. You have a letter from the Fish and Game Department in your packets. It includes a list of the items that have been purchased, the tags and the licenses that have been purchased over the last year, and the revenues from those tags and licenses. The proposed change to the resident requirements in this bill would not affect eligibility for permanent fund, dividend checks, or jury pools. And you have a letter to that effect, or an email to that effect, from Jerry Burnett in the Department of Revenue in your packets. I'd also like to draw your attention to the fact that this bill, as currently drafted, eliminates the guide requirement for hunting brown bear, grizzly bear, mountain goat, and sheep. Members of the military are trained to rigorous physical and technical standards that typically exceed those of the average person and are typically more familiar with challenging terrain and changing weather patterns. And currently, a guide is required to hunt those four species. You have in your packet a letter from the Alaska Professional Hunters Association in opposition to that component of the bill. The January 1, 2009 effective date, as written in the bill, allows the Department of Fish and Game to revise, print, and distribute application forms that reflect information accurately and work with the vendors and applicants to achieve compliance with this new law, and is their standard practice to start at a calendar year when changing their application. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, it has been suggested that the aim of Senate Bill 214 as drafted could be better accomplished by amending the current statutes that define residency within this Fish and Game Code specifically. And I've got a copy of a work draft that you don't have in your packets that would accomplish that goal. It's a different way to attack the same issue, and if you decide to go that route, we can bring forward a substitute. Mr. Kevin Saxby is on the line from the Department of Law, and he can speak to the differences between the two statutes. Also for your consideration, Representative Bill Thomas has respectfully requested that the committee consider pulling in some of the language from his House Bill 62 and placing it in this bill, and thereby including members of the National Guard under this language change. You will need an updated fiscal note if you make that change, and a substitute or an amendment. And Ms. Chris Wright, from the department is here with some information on the change to the fiscal note if you'd like to hear about that. Lastly, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, today you will hear from a number of people, including Chris Wright, as I mentioned. She's the licensing and financial supervisor for the department, and she's here to answer your questions. Again, Mr. Kevin Saxby is online from the Department of Law, and he can discuss the legal particulars about this bill and why going through another statute might be a better approach, and also address concerns about department's concern about attacking residency as a definition. They've got some issues with that, and he can walk you through that. Also online, Mr. Rick Davidge from the Anchorage LIO. He is chairman of the Alaska Veterans Association to speak to the bill. And Mr. Bob Fithian, who is the Alaska Professional Hunters Association, is also online to discuss their concerns about the elimination of the guiding component. Mr. Chairman, that concludes my presentation, and I will try to answer questions if you have them.
Okay, questions for Jody? Yeah, Senator Stevens.
Thank you, Chairman. Just sort of a minor point, but this is an act relating to big game hunting by non-resident members of the military service. You referenced House Bill 62 that says we should include the National Guard. Wouldn't the National Guard be included under this anyway, as a non-resident member of the military service?
Through the chair to Senator Stevens,
Let me help Jody on that a little
bit. Thank you, sir.
Okay. The DMVA has requested as a recruiting tool, if you will, that we look at the provision whereby, if you're in the National Guard, that you would be entitled to a hunting and fishing license by virtue of your membership. So, that has a whole different physical impact, but they see that as a recruiting mechanism, and I think McHugh is here, Mac will talk to that a little bit later, and that's done in some states, and quite frankly, some much larger provisions for things that happen. And it's kind of along the lines of what's different, but I don't know. There's an education benefit, and if you are a National Guard person, you go abroad and you're killed, and your kids get an education benefit within the state, in the state university system, as long as your family lives within the state. So it's kind of an extension of that sort of mentality. But that's outside the bill at this point in time. Let's talk about the first piece, and we'll go to the second piece. And so I'm sorry, go ahead.
That's, I just want to make sure if we get to that point,
the difference is. Let me explain my thought process as we looked at this. I talked to General Frazier, and I talked to the Army commander in addition about where we were and what we were doing. And if you read the newspaper here in the last 6 months, you will notice that particularly up in Fairbanks, there were some soldiers that were apprehended because they were buying in-state license when they weren't entitled to it. Now, and each of the commanders says, we cannot justify that. But we had a conversation about it because, in fact, all the large troop concentration states, Georgia, Alabama, Mississippi, North Carolina, South Carolina, when you move there as a military person under orders for hunting and fishing privileges, you're entitled to buy in-state license. And this would bring us in line with in other places where soldiers and sailors and airmen are stationed. South Carolina is the most permissive. If you're stationed in the 82nd Airborne Division at Fort Bragg, North Carolina, and you go on leave, it's called a DA-31, you take that and you go to South Carolina, and that's your hunting license. You're, says, I'm on vacation. And they say, well, sure, you're, come hunt. We like you here in South Carolina. You're a service member. So that's the most permissive. Now, and then it gets a little extraneous, and let me just use an example. Because our permanent fund, the way it's set up, if you are a service member from Alaska, graduated from Wasilla High School, and you're at Fort Benning, Georgia, and you go down and you buy a resident hunting license, which you're entitled to, the permanent fund starts to question whether or not you're choosing Georgia as your residence, which is, I mean, think about it for a moment. If you're a young private and you're in Fort Benning, Georgia, and the guy says, look, you're entitled to this $5 license here, why would you want to pay $125 for a license? It has nothing to do with where your residence is, but our permanent fund interprets it that way, and it kind of triggers another mechanism. This, I think, would get us kind of over the hump mentally in the respect that it would put us in line with some others, and we would maybe see that a little bit different. Now, there's some hurdles. And we will hear from Mr. Saxby how, because we have three species that you have to have a guide to hunt in Alaska if you're non-resident, and it's brown bears, goats, and dall sheep. And that's maybe on weak ground legally. And if we exempted those three species under the provision of this bill, then it might further weaken that. So that's one of the ramifications we're looking at, having that remain in place. So if you are a military person that moved to Fort Richardson under orders, permanent change of station, that lo and behold, you would still need a guide in the first year if you went bear hunting, goat hunting, or sheep hunting to try to protect that resident. We'll hear more about that. And I think that sort of sums it up in a nutshell, if that made sense to most of you. You know, it's really a sad state when you think about this for a moment. If you were in the Airborne Brigade that just got back from Iraq, a whole bunch of those young men and young women showed up in Alaska, were here for a matter of months, and then deployed to Iraq. And would you rather have your son or daughter down at the Bush Company, or you name your place, would you rather have them out carrying a 7-mag around chasing some critter? Well, that's easy for me to answer in that respect. And I think that's one of the ways that I would encourage us to look at it. And, oh, by the way, would not have them automatically out of compliance if they bought a state hunting license like they are entitled to in other states. But with that, let's go to Mr. Kevin. Yes, sir. Yes, Senator White.
I had to say one thing, Mr. Chairman. In the first place, in Georgia, South Carolina, North Carolina, they don't have grizzly bear, brown bear, mountain sheep, or goat. We do. We have a limited number of those animals. Now, I would have no problem with us making it easier for a military person that's transferred in on a permanent basis to go black bear hunting and to go brown bear hunting where the Department of Game has found that there is an overabundance of those bears. But to take a resource like we're taking here, that's a very valuable resource as far as income that comes in for guided hunts, et cetera, I just think this is not something that I personally want to do. And I have every respect in the world for GIs and military personnel, but at the same time, we need to be careful in our game management and what we do with our game. And I just think this is entirely the wrong thing to do with our game. These are trophy animals. These are animals sought after by some of the greatest hunters in the world. And we have an industry in this state that takes people out to bag those animals. And I think we need to be very careful where we're going with things like this. A similar bill was before us 2 years ago by a friend of mine from Fairbanks, and he wanted to make it so that every person in the state of Alaska could take, I forget how the relationship was, but take them hunting in place of a guide. So I was against that bill, and I got to say, I'm not in favor of this the way it's written. I think we'd have to do a lot of work on this and substitute maybe for brown bears, black bears, and then brown and grizzly bears only if there's a determination by the Board of Game that there's an excess number that are not being harvested by guides, or there's a let's say there's a subspecies of bear, brown bear, that aren't as large as
guides look for trophy animals. But I think we need to be very careful what we're doing here.
Well, I mean, good people sometimes can disagree, so, and that may be the category this falls into, please.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Do we have any indication of how many military members are actually exercising their right to go on guided hunts now, and how many we would expect would be going, take advantage of this bill if it were to pass? I know it's probably a little, the second part's probably a little bit hard. Do we have any kind of indications on that?
Through the chair to Senator Bulakowski, I just draw your attention to the letter that the Fish and Game Department provided, and with that is a list of the license and tags that were in 2006 that were applied for or purchased. For example, with the concern over the brown bear and grizzly bear, three were actually sold last year. So you can kind of look at an order of magnitude for how many people would fall into this category. I'm not able to predict the future. The department has some trend lines that they could speak to, but last year's statistics say, for example, three people applied for the military brown bear, grizzly bear permit or tag.
Yes.
Simple follow-up on that subject, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah.
How many of those were successful hunts?
Through the chair to Senator Stedman, I'm not sure about that. I'm understanding that this bill will be heard and held, and we can get that information back to you if you'd like.
Correct, because I'm pretty sure they'd be reporting that to the authorities.
Yeah, I think it's fair to say for the three species we're talking about, the 10% rule probably applies for success rate for non-guided hunts. And let's not forget that if some of my first kindred came up here, that I can take them doll sheep hunting, or I can take them goat hunting, or I can take them brow bear hunting. I don't need a guide. So there are lots of provisions where you don't need a guide, and you can take people hunting, just invite them to come up, and you just go. Yes, Senator Bulakowski.
I'm just wondering if we have any kind of best estimates on how many members of the military or their dependents would take advantage of this law if it were passed. And I know it's difficult to predict. I wonder if there are any other states that we can look at to see maybe how many members of those military take advantage of their preferences.
A percent. Through the chair to Senator Bulakowski, I'll get that information for you. I'll do some research and see what I can bring back. It may be a percentage. It may not be an exact number.
I'd just be curious. I think it's interesting data.
Yeah, nationally, the hunting rate of license holders is something less than 20% of the total population. Now, when you boil that down to military, I'm not sure. Obviously, females would be less than males, but it's probably a higher percentage overall. Okay, let's go. Anything else?
No, sir.
Okay, let's go to Mr. Kevin Saxby. And Kevin, Senator Wagner brought up some points which you and I and Jody have talked about. So if you would expound on that a little bit, specifically about intensive management areas where predators are, in fact, a problem, and what we run into if we try to make those provisions.
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, put yourself on the record, if you would.
Kevin Saxby, the Senior Assistant Attorney General that is assigned to the Board of Game and the Division of Wildlife Conservation. And to make a long story short, I think the concerns that I've raised about the bill are set forth pretty clearly in the letter that you have from the lawyer for the Alaska Professional Hunters Association. That letter addresses the constitutional issues related to our non-resident guide requirement for the three species you've been talking about. We can go into that a little bit more, but I think it's pretty clear. And you'd asked, Mr. Chairman, about what happens if we try to incorporate some language about intensive management areas. That's been discussed by the legislature in the past, and it raises those same issues. Our constitutional justifications for treating residents and non-residents differently in this area, for requiring guides for non-residents on these three species, are, first of all, dangerous conditions and dangerous game, and or dangerous game. But second, these are species that, with the exception of mountain goat, are unique to Alaska. And mountain goat are not found in very many other places. So they're all three very unique species, and we have a lot of unique rules about them that you wouldn't expect non-residents to be familiar with, but resident hunters should be fairly familiar with. So those are the distinctions that have been drawn. When we start creating exceptions either for the types of non-residents we're going to apply this law to, or for the areas in the state where we're going to apply the exception to, in either case, we weaken the defensibility of the distinctions that we've drawn. Have I answered your question, Mr. Chair?
Yes, yes, you have. I'm looking for the letter that we received. Yeah, for professionals, I have it now that everybody has a copy. Mm-hmm.
Where do you find that chart?
You have questions for Mr. Saxby? Yep. Yep, Senator Wilikowski.
Mr. Saxby, just wondering what would the standard of review be in this analysis when you're looking at out-of-state residents? Is it strict scrutiny or a rational basis? And then what would be the standard if we for upholding this statute if we did apply it to military members?
Through the chair, the standard of review would most likely be in federal courts, would most likely be the lowest standard of review, the rational basis test. That's what they applied in the past. But that's still a test that matters. And I think both the advice I've given and the advice that you've gotten from Mr. Horn takes into account that it isn't a very high level of proof that has to be met, but it does matter. And every step we take to somewhat weaken our arguments is at least something that the legislature should be aware of as they're moving in that direction. Have I gotten the answer that you were looking for?
Yeah, so we would have to show that we had a rational basis for having the special legislation for military members, as opposed to a different standard for people who aren't military members. Is that would be the standard?
I think so. I think practically speaking, what you'd want to show is that there is a reason to view recently arrived military members differently from your general run-of-the-mill non-resident on both the areas of their ability to face dangerous conditions and dangerous games, and in the area of their knowledge of Alaska's very unique hunting regulation.
Thank you.
Yeah, Mr. Saxby, in our conversations, and a little bit along the lines that Senator Wagner had pointed out, you know, I'm of the opinion that we should exclude the three species that are guided for more on keeping down the profile of a potential challenge you know, in the courts as far as the legality of requiring guides for those and for any other rationale. But could you talk to us a little bit about that?
Mr. Chairman, is the suggestion that Section 2 be essentially eliminated? Is that what you're asking about?
That's correct.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. I think that removes all of the concerns that I've articulated here.
Okay. Does that make sense to members? Essentially, the three species that require a guide would be excluded from this provision. Said another way, if you're a military member, you PCS here, permit change of station, on orders, then you can get a resident hunting license and resident permits for anything other than brown bears, sheep, or goats. Yep, Senator Wilikowski.
Yeah, so Mr. Saxby, if we remove those, in your opinion, is there any constitutional basis to challenge this, the remainder of the bill?
There's almost always an argument someone can come up with, and even in Section 1, of course, residents and non-residents are being treated differently. To be precise, I think we need to recognize that. Oh, I'm sorry. Was I muted?
No. No, go ahead.
Going to be. Oh, okay. Good. What Section 1 does is it does not currently authorize, as I read it, it doesn't authorize them to receive resident licenses. It authorizes them to receive special non-resident military licenses that cost the same as resident licenses. And I think that's an important distinction. But to get more to Senator Wilikowski's question, we are still treating people different, but it's a different debate at this point. We're not talking about whether non-residents in general are qualified to face dangerous conditions, dangerous game, and are aware of our specific regulations on those species. Instead, we're talking about whether there's any legitimate state reason to treat military non-residents differently from other garden variety non-residents. I think that's a different debate, and it's an easier defense to make. Military personnel are transferred here against their will, for example. They're transferred here in the interest of national security. And in Alaska, the state of Alaska certainly has a legitimate state interest in contributing to national security. So it's just a different debate than the debate we'd have over the guide requirement, and I think it's a much easier defense to make.
Thank you.
Yes. Senator McGuire.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm almost wondering, I know what the goal is of the bill, and I'm almost wondering whether it would be better to tackle it as a specific license that we grant for the public policy basis of, you know, honoring our military the way we did when we made disabled veterans licenses free, and put it that way as opposed to crafting it in the way it is, which redefines resident. And it's just something to think about for the next hearing, but I understand the point that there's a lot of things that, you know, reference resident and non-resident in the hunting and fishing statutes, but I think more defensible, more clear, we don't start getting into some of the other areas of the law where we distinguish between residents and non-residents getting blurred, and we just simply say there's a special license that with a special fee that we're going to allow, and I don't know, and it comes with whatever those privileges are that we want to add to it. I just get a little concerned. I know it says for the purposes of this statute, but I get a little concerned about precedent, and I wonder if other places in the law we're going to start blurring that line, and I do still wonder if there aren't legal questions about that blurring of the line and how defensible it is.
Mr. Saxby, did you hear Senator McGuire's concern?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Is there something you'd like me to comment on there?
Well, yeah. I mean, if you could either support or, you know, have any comments you might have on her concerns.
Well, you and I had a conversation about this, Mr. Chairman, and since then I've thought a lot about it, and I guess I still think that the neatest, simplest way to do it is to make recently arrived military transferees who are permanently stationed here, just authorize them to be resident, to acquire a resident license. Because as I just explained, I think that shifts the debate completely to a much more objective and fair-sounding debate, because military people are here for different reasons than anyone else is here. And it's easy to defend treating them separately in that instance.
Okay, so through the chair, so your point is that rather than focusing on the service to our country, you're focusing more on the fact that they're stationed here for a reason. I was just thinking about how we treat bills running through my mind that we had for disabled veterans and going ahead and making that fishing license free. And it seemed to me that there was justification for treating them differently. I see your rationale.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I agree, but I wasn't trying to shift discussion away from the service to our country. I think that's part of the overall reason for treating them differently, as residents rather than as non-residents.
Yeah, and thank you, Mr. Saxby, on that. My two cents and experience with it is that in the language, as I recall, in the states that I have experience with, is for the purposes of hunting and fishing, PCS military and dependents are considered a resident. period. So there's no ambiguity, and there's no extension beyond that. It's just period. When you go someplace and you go to buy a hunting license or a fishing license and your permit change of station, you're living in that location, then you're considered a resident for licensing, for period, for those two items. That's pretty short and succinct. In this case, there's an exception that would still require the guide provision for the three dangerous game pieces. And Mr. Saxby, I think I was napping, but under intensive management, as I recall, you said that was a complicated subject to try to get people out under special provisions to be able to hunt black bears or brown bears in 16 Bravo as the example.
Yeah, you got the essence of what I said, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. All right. Good. Good. Other questions for Mr. Saxby? Okay, we will now go to Mr. Robert Fithian, Alaska Professional Hunters Association. Mr. Fithian, are you there?
Chairman Huggins, can you hear me?
Yes, loud and clear.
Okay. Chairman Huggins, Senate Resource Committee members, once again, for the record, this is Bobby Fithian, Executive Director of the Alaska Professional Hunters Association, testifying on SB 214. The Alaska Professional Hunters Association cannot express enough the respect and honor for our United States military personnel and their dependents who, in times of active war and non-war, give them and dedicate their lives for America. We also are very cognizant and supportive of the concerns brought forward in the sponsor's statement for this bill. Additionally, we are aware of the low pay these great Americans receive for their duty, and we comprehend fully and are sympathetic for the problem of them being challenged to facilitate the funds for non-resident hunting licenses and big game tags for themselves and their dependents at the existing cost. However, as the bill is written, it would provide for special treatment of non-resident military personnel to hunt Alaska's guide-required big game species. And as so, we forwarded the bill to our expert legal counsel, Bill Horn, who specializes in natural resource and fish and wildlife law, for a review of this bill. And I believe each of you have a copy of his analysis. In short, as Mr. Horn provides in his letter, we recognize and agree with the desire to avoid posing undue burdens on our military members and to acknowledge and honor them for their service. However, to preserve the constitutionality of Alaska's guide requirement for non-resident hunters, we would strongly counsel against authorizing any exception to the guide requirement for non-resident military and dependents of non-resident military on active duty and permanently stationed in Alaska. Mr. Horn provides the basis for his recommendations for your review within his letter, and the APHA strongly concurs with the summary. Chairman Huggins, we support your effort with this piece of legislation and would be very willing to work with you to generate a version of this bill that would meet our common goals and best interest concerns. Please know that we are here to assist you to that end. And respectfully, Mr. Chairman and committee members, thank you for allowing us to testify today and for being there for Alaska. I'll be online here if you need me to assist you with any questions. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Fithian. Questions or comments for Mr. Fithian? Yeah, and Bob, if I might, I've come to the conclusion maybe a couple of weeks ago that the Professional Hunters Association was correct, and it complicates our life legally if we don't make a provision for the three danger species. So consider that done at this point in time mentally, and we'll visit with you on the language for it.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. And next we'll go to Mr. Rick Davich in Anchorage.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is Rick Davich. I'm State Council President of Vietnam Veterans of America for Alaska, Chairman of the Alaska Veterans Foundation, and Acting Chairman of VETPAC in Alaska. Just a couple of quick points. We make an effort across the state, within our communities and certainly statewide, to embrace the active duty members of the military while they're here and their families. And as a former member of the U.S. military, I can agree with the chairman's assessment of what happens, particularly in Georgia and the Carolinas. When you're there, you show your military ID and you're treated as a resident. But we do have differences in Alaska, particularly with these big game species. I also suggest to you, and I sent Jody an email about it earlier today, that there's a growing concern about the words military service on active duty includes. With the transfer of the U.S. Coast Guard to the Department of Homeland Security, there are some that are arguing in various bills, et cetera, that takes them out of the active duty service. And I would just suggest, rather than having to come back at some later date and amend the law, that we simply make it clear that the active duty military service includes members of the U.S. Coast Guard and their dependents. Finally, I would just observe that the harvest of big game is a function of season and bag limits, which are regulated by the Department of Fish and Game. And I think that takes care of the harvesting question. And certainly people with guides and outfitters are generally much more successful with harvesting than those that do not have them. I would like to encourage some future hearings on this bill and certainly passing the bills so we begin to really begin to treat these temporary residents, if you will, who often become permanent residents as residents of the state of Alaska. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Davidge. Questions or comments for Mr. Davidge? Thank you. And let's next go here in the room to Ms. Christian Wright. Please.
I'm just here to answer questions.
Okay. Okay. Anybody have it? You're here representing?
Department of Fish and Game.
Oh, Department of Fish and Game. And what's the department's position on this? Why don't you come up and put yourself on the record?
I'm Kristen Wright with the Alaska Department of Fish and Game, and I'm the Finance and Licensing Supervisor. And I believe, Senator Huggins, you asked what the department's position on this. Mm-hmm. And I believe I'm going to say neutral. I mean, we're supporting of the bill. We don't, of course, we want to take into consideration the AG's opinion about how this would be processed.
You say the administration is neutral?
Well, or in support.
In support? Okay. Yeah, I'm just trying to, you know, so we got it for the record.
Yeah, we're very supportive.
You're supportive. Okay.
Can I ask?
Yes, Senator McGuire.
Thank you. Through the chair, this is interesting. I just was noting on the fiscal note from your office that ADF&G in 2006 received $52,100 in sport license and big game tag sales from military personnel. And if all military personnel could purchase them at resident rates, the department would lose $31,900. That's amazing. That's a lot of people. And so I guess what, Mr. Chairman, we would want to do is in their budgeting process, I guess if this policy goes forward, make that consideration for the future. I know that ADF&G has had concerns in the past about the resources they have already. So if we make this policy change, support it financially.
Yeah.
And through the chair, Senator McGuire, we would also lose a 25% matching requirement. And so that would add another 8,000 to that. And so it's 39.9. is what we feel we would lose.
Yeah, Senator, well, I'm sorry, follow up?
Just real briefly, Mr. Chairman, what is the matching requirement?
Through the chair, Senator McGuire, when we get federal grants, we have to use matching funds in order to, and it's usually at 25%. The federal government will give us 75%, okay. And we have to match it with fish and game funds or general fund. And we usually use fish and game funds because that's what we have as the department. We would lose that ability to use those funds.
Okay, Senator Wilikowski.
Do you expect that the number of licenses that military members purchase will increase if we pass this bill?
Through the chair. I believe, yes, we will definitely see an increase because I think some people don't purchase now because of the cost. I would like to address one question that for Kevin Saxby that we need to work out. I am somewhat concerned that you're now taking that they wouldn't buy a military license at a resident rate. Because right now, when you go up to a vendor and you buy a resident license, you fill out a box how many months and years you've been in Alaska. Well, if I have a person putting 1 month on, I'm going to have a vendor go, you're not a resident. And I have 1,600 vendors throughout the state. We have Walmart, Fred Meyer employees who aren't, it's hard to educate them. I have a feeling that we're going to have problems with military if we just have them buy a resident license. If I have them buy a military license at the resident rate, then they will not question why they are not, haven't been here for 12 months. So that's one thing I need to work out.
And I guess that was kind of my next question. Well, I guess two questions. And following up on what you just said, will military members have to live in this? I guess there's some requirements where you have to live in the state for 12 months. Will they have to live in the state for 12 months to undertake certain hunts? I know for subsistence fishing, for instance, you have to live in the state for 12 months before you can go dip net. Is there any hunting requirements like that? Because then you get into a whole other equal protection issue of you're actually treating them better than you're treating Alaskan residents.
Through the chair, Senator, I'm not familiar totally with hunting requirements, but I know there are some registration hunts. I don't know what those requirements are, and I don't know if there is some 1 year, so I'd need to follow up on that.
I'm sorry, I missed you're not familiar with what now?
With all the hunting requirements for the state. He was asking if there's some registration permits or right. Registration, yeah, where you have to actually go to a field office and register
right. Yeah,
before
you, just fill
you go
out
to hunt.
Right. Right.
Not just the big game permits that you can,
correct.
That is a lottery that
correct.
You win.
Correct.
I mean registration permits. And I don't know if those registration permits, but Kevin Saxby would know. If those have to be 12 months or not before you can
you
get a registration.
You have to show your license. You have to show license.
And that's it?
But Mr. Saxby can answer that. Mr. Saxby, did you hear the question reference registration hunts?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I heard it.
Yeah, could you give us, what the requirement ramifications are?
Yes, sir. All of the requirements that relate to what particular rules apply for hunting a particular species during a particular season, what that bag limit might be, whether one may participate in subsistence opportunities or not, all of those are driven by whether one is defined as a resident or a non-resident. And so if you're looking at changing the definition of resident to add military personnel who are permanently stationed here, they will qualify under all of the rules that apply to residents.
Mr. Saxby, are there certain hunts that you're required to be a resident for 12 months in order to actually do that hunt or in order to get a resident rate?
Through the chair, no. The 12-month requirement is to be a resident in the first place. After that, there are no additional requirements. There are many hunts where you must be a resident, all subsistence hunts, for example.
So,
but that's driven by the definition of what is a resident. Currently, that definition is someone who's, I'm paraphrasing, but essentially someone who is permanently here for 12 months.
So if I could follow up, if we go the route where we're saying that they're residents, are we getting into some sort of equal protection issue where you have two people living in Alaska, one Alaskan, let's say, who lives here and has lived here for 11 months, maybe is not eligible for that, and then someone who moves in here, a member of the military for a short time, do we get into some kind of any kind of legal problems with doing that?
Through the chair. We do, but again, it's the same argument I was addressing earlier, where there's a very legitimate and rational basis, I think, to draw distinctions at that level. Military personnel are stationed here because they're ordered here in the first place. Now, other non-residents could argue, well, their job required them to come here too. but they can quit that job and leave anytime. Military personnel can't. They face severe penalties. So they're, first of all, the coercive level of them being here is greater than for any other type of recent arrivee. Second, they're here because there's a national security reason for them being here. So I think those are legitimate distinctions that separate them out from any other type of recent non-resident arrival. And you could recognize that if you want to.
Okay. Kristen, any other comments or any other questions for Kristen? Okay, Senator Wagner.
One quick question. I notice here it also refers to fishing licenses. Now, we currently grant people from Yukon Territory a resident license. Does this mean that we also grant the military a resident fishing license as well as a hunting license?
Through the chair, Senator, what we actually do with the Yukon is that they can purchase a Yukon license at the resident rate. They don't purchase a resident license.
Yeah.
Okay.
And yes, according to this bill, this would also be for fishing licenses.
So this number of personnel then would be immediately eligible for dipnet fisheries throughout the state of Alaska. Because to be eligible for dipnet fishery, you had to have a resident fishing license.
Yeah.
For a year.
Through the chair.
Not for a year, not if this goes through.
Senator Wagner, you would be correct, but Kevin would need to answer that. But that's, I believe, what he told before. Yes.
Yeah, Mr. Saxby, would you like to address that?
Mr. Chairman, as I read the bill currently, the law would not change as to non-resident fishing licenses. They're currently allowed to get a non-resident fishing sport fishing license at the resident rate. That does not entitle them to participate in subsistence and personal use fisheries until they've been here for 12 months.
Oh, okay.
If you were to go along with my suggestion, which is a very off-the-cuff suggestion at this point, I agree would need a lot of work, but qualify them as residents, then the concerns that were raised earlier would come into play. They would be residents for both hunting and fishing purposes, and they would qualify for any resident opportunity.
Okay. Thank you very much, Kristen. Is there anyone else that would like to testify on this bill? And I just as a testimonial, this past weekend, Safari Club International had their banquet in Anchorage. And I saw some of the faces in this room there. And they had, I think, four military members there that all walked with some distinctive limp, some worse than others. Some had canes because it didn't work out too well for them in Iraq. And I remind you that 50-some of the soldiers went with the Airborne Brigade to Iraq, didn't come back to Alaska. They went to a burial ground someplace. And we need to think about that in the business of young men and women that come here to, they don't, you know, some may have asked to come here, but by and large they're assigned here. And the implications of that, how are we going to host them? And whether we're, and you know, quite frankly, I remember when there was a debate going on about we're going to close down some military facilities in Fairbanks. This body allocated, I think, $1 million to keep it open, as I recall. And some people went up there and made great speeches and coordination and all those things because we wanted the military guys here. And, you know, I can understand some concerns about, you know, what they do here. But, you know, it's better than going to the Bush Company. Mm. And they have a mother and a father someplace. And, you know, most of them, quite frankly, as privates, don't get paid very much. So I'm one of those that would encourage us to think about how we can be more cordial hosts And I, quite frankly, I was dismayed for those young men and women that got caught because they bought a license and they weren't a resident, how one of our state officials characterized they may have been exploiting the resource. It was interesting how that was in print. It bothered me a little bit when I saw that. So with that, we will set this bill aside and go to, excuse me.
Mr. Chairman, can I just say something
yes.
real quickly? I think I speak for everyone on the committee, but when I say that I hold the highest regard for the men and women that serve our country, I think what the debate we've had today centers around is how to do that. And I think it's more a question of whether I personally can say that I am supportive of honoring our military and hosting them well, and have voted for provisions in the past that give special licenses. My only question and concern is going to the resident statute itself. That is, so I want to be clear on the record that my comments are construed only about the style of the bill and how it comes at the problem, not the fact that I'm not supportive of our military and hosting them well.
Okay, let's go now to Senate Bill 246. And we'll bring the bill sponsor forward. Welcome, Senator Thomas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good afternoon to the committee. Just a few brief comments to reintroduce, so to speak, sponsor substitute for SB 246. Absent reviewing Susitna and other hydroelectric potential in the state, we are allowing ourselves to slip back to where we were basically in 1984 and expect that gas and oil will somehow be the cheapest source of fuel for energy and power production. In the early 1980s, gas was 21 to 25 cents per 1,000 cubic feet. Diesel was about $1 a gallon, or was actually less than $1 a gallon, and river water was free. The Susitna Dam was about a $5.2 billion project at that time. Today, Cook Inlet natural gas to the electrical production facilities is about $5.57 per million BTUs, and diesel goes for about $3 to $3.85 per gallon on the road system, and as much as $8 a gallon in the villages. Oil is selling for $100 a barrel, and natural gas outside Alaska is $9.22 per million BTUs, and river water is still free. Recent news stories have highlighted the decision of several of our electric utilities to construct a new 260-megawatt natural gas power plant in Anchorage. Contrast this announcement with the recent news that Texas has passed California as our nation's largest producer of wind energy, with nearly 3,000 megawatts of wind power generating capacity. We may be entirely too focused on how we've always done things instead of considering new, more efficient, more beneficial courses of action. Norway is an oil producer. However, I believe that 90% of their power is hydroelectric. They use the most efficient, sustainable resource that they have. Nothing indicates that natural gas prices will stabilize, and certainly no one believes the price will ever go down other than for short periods of time before increasing beyond its previous high. This is and will be the trend as natural gas and oil become more scarce. Oil and gas exploration and development costs continue to rise. A quick look at capital and operating expenses at Prudhoe Bay and the cost of drilling confirms these facts. These costs will continue to increase. Gas-fired electrical turbines are not the solution, nor are they the best and most efficient use of our gas. Our gas will no doubt command the highest price when and if it is sold outside of Alaska, and it should be, to maximize its benefit to Alaska and her citizens. Some will be used in existing infrastructure for heating purposes or to bolster industrial efforts in Alaska. This is a reasonable and efficient use of gas in state. However, gas is not the most efficient power generating fuel. The top of the line next generation natural gas turbines only achieve an efficiency of 60%. And even this modest level of efficiency was thought impossible as recently as the early 1990s. No plan to date suggests in-state use of gas as the highest and best use of our resource. I personally see it as a great potential for industrial use and heating, but not power generation. TransCanada and all of the AGEA proposals are export proposals, other than the bullet line to South Central Alaska. Our resources are stretched to the point that Agrium closes down and we have to negotiate with Cook Inlet producers over exporting LNG, which Nikiski has done for 30 years, versus consumer use in South Central Alaska. We are still on the road. Let's learn from the past. Let's do it differently. Let's do our best to change our ways and see some different and better results. Again, Cook Inlet natural gas is 557 per million BTU, 22 times what it was in 1984, and diesel goes for $3 to $3.85 per gallon on the roads system and $8 in the villages. Oil is selling for $100 a barrel, natural gas outside Alaska, 922 per million BTU, and river water is still free. A $2 to $3 million study is roughly the same amount of money we expend as a state every 2 to 3 hours of every day of the year. That's every day, every week of the year under our current budget. 2 to 3 hours of spending to decide what energy source we should use to power our future. I believe that this is not only worthwhile, but an essential use of our state's resources. Nothing is as comprehensive an approach to reducing costs, emissions, and dependent on finite, non-renewable energy production for the rail belt and adjacent areas as a Susitna Dam project and other potential hydro sources. Mr. Chairman, thank you for your attention and the committee's time. I encourage and appreciate your support for this legislation. I have with me Grier Hopkins from my office to answer some of the questions raised at our previous presentation, and he has a few brief comments, and also we have Sarah Fisher Goad from the Alaska Energy Authority, who will also testify to clarify some questions that you had from our last go-round. And I believe we also have three people online that would testify on the bill if there's time.
Good.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Senator Thomas. Questions for Senator Thomas? Okay, thank you. And if we could have Sarah, could you come forward, please? I'll tell you what, Senator Thomas, why don't you remain there in case we have some questions that come forward. Please just put yourself on the record, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Sarah Fisher Goad. I'm the Acting Executive Director of the Alaska Energy Authority, and I'm here to just clarify the Palin administration's position with respect to this planning that's proposed in Senate Bill 246. The administration does support the analysis of the Susitna project and the additional planning and regional planning effort that's required in Senate Bill 246. Last week, there was some discussion on whether this project could be addressed as a capital project, and that is technically correct that it could be addressed as a capital project. However, the administration is not taking a position with respect to what vehicle the legislature chooses to address this project. And then just on a broader note, that as you're aware, that the governor and the AEA Board of Directors will soon be announcing the appointment of an energy coordinator that will also be the AEA executive director. And this person will be the person that will direct this rail belt regional planning and also a statewide comprehensive planning effort. So thank you for your time. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Yeah, questions for Ms. Goad? Could just review with us what we could anticipate the AEA bringing back to us as a product.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The product that we would anticipate bringing back is detailed with respect to, in the fiscal note that we've provided to the committee. There are 13 objectives that have been addressed in Senate Bill 246. And what we did in the fiscal note is kind of group those objectives in specific work tasks with that. And so, like, for example, work task one, we would anticipate it would be the feasibility study and the estimate of the plant and of the generated power costs. Work task two would be an environmental and the socioeconomic impact study. And work task three would be the cost of power for selected alternatives. And the issue is to look at Susitna not as itself, but to, you know, it shouldn't be looked at and analyzed in a vacuum, that there should be addressing other energy sources and other projects potentially in the rail belt region. There's a work task four, which is the financing options for the project. There is an integrated systems energy plan for the rail belt as a work task five. There is the creation of a project advisory group. We do have an estimated cost for that. I believe that has been adjusted slightly in the sponsor substitute that Senator Thomas has provided. There is some limited field work that has been suggested. We do suggest this as, even through the fiscal note, if Senate Bill 246 does pass, to be capital appropriations, possibly an FY 2009 of $2.8 million and an FY 2010 of $1.5 million. So it's a three-page fiscal note, I think, that details fairly well what would be expected in a study, in a study dealing with Susitna with this regional planning that's anticipated in Senate Bill 246. And as I testified to last week, too, if this was something that would become a capital project, if that was the deliberations of the legislature, we would probably take what is addressed here and apply that to backup for a capital project.
And, yes, yeah, Senator, do you have a question?
Yeah,
Senator Stedman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm just kind of curious because it looks like, and I definitely agree with the broader scope, especially Objective 4, you know, when we're going to do a comparison from coal or with coal, natural gas, geothermal, tidal, and hydro. But isn't this more of a broader energy study than a concentration on just the Susitna Dam? Isn't that just one component that, so this could be pretty much inversed?
Through the chair, Senator Stedman, I think the regional planning, or at least how we've interpreted what Senator Thomas had in mind in Senate Bill 246, I think does get to that. I think Susitna, because it was a project that was studied, and there was a lot of expenditures back in the 80s with respect to this project. I think one of the questions that has come up is, should we have pursued this project 20 years ago? And I think, you know, because of how big it is and because of how much work has gone into it, it would be an important part to address the entire rail belt study. I think I can't remember the name in Fairbanks that had studied. I think they had addressed and they had looked at Susitna as a potential project. And we have a library full of studies and some other information that we've already put out on our on our webpage to address Susitna. So I believe that it is part of this regional planning, but because it's been something that's been studied so much, that I don't think there's an intention that other projects such as the Chakashamna project that was discussed last week, there isn't an idea not to pursue those others or to analyze those. However, I think Susitna is big enough and has been studied that it needs a second look.
Yeah, it appears that Susitna just creates its own wake, so to speak, because of the sheer size of it. But isn't this more of a energy analysis of the rail belt, the population centers of the state? So once this study is done, then we'd have a better chance of optimizing our selection of how we're going to generate energy for the rail belt when we go ahead and decide what we're going to appropriate capital to?
Through the chair, Senator Stedman, I believe that is the intent, that this is, this would give you some comprehensive planning. At least that's what's been intended with respect to these work tests that we've outlined.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Yep. Yeah, and just for clarification, I mean, essentially the power at Susitna could reach down to Homer all the way up to the Fairbanks area is sort of the scope of what would be in the power grid. Version Echo physical note, can you give us some insight into what difference there may be in the physical note?
That is the sponsor substitute version?
Right, correct.
I believe without looking too closely at that, I believe the work test would be the same. So I think the most of the issues will be the same. I think what we probably would not necessarily need is this project advisory group. However, I'd have to take a look at that because I think there is the intent to have us consult with affected entities and to kind of help develop this product. So I could see us not necessarily needing an advisory group, but having advisory meetings. Mm-hmm. So that would be something that I would like to take a look at, but I'm not certain if it would cost $50,000, but the rail belt is a quite large area, so, you know, there would be it may not be an advisory group, but there would be advisory meetings and, you know, maybe some stakeholder groups. We've taken similar approaches to other projects that we've conducted, including the Railroad Electrical Grid Authority study that we've been looking at.
Yeah, we're going to ask for a motion to bring ECHO before us.
Second, Mr. Chairman.
And while we're waiting on that, Senator Thomas, any, on the advisory group, any comments or thoughts you might have?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. That was some concern about, you know, creating an unruly path, and so we changed. That's the major change in the sponsor substitute is to change that to simply consulting with the groups rather than with various departments and other folks that are in holders along the within the area rather than incorporating them into the study as a part of a working group. That language is removed. Those people are simply to be consulted with because we think they would be helpful, obviously, as this moves forward in shortening up some of the questions that are asked and providing information as well, but they're to be consulted with. They're not to be formed in some group.
Right, and you're supportive of the change, sir?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. There was some additional discussion that I had with Senator Thomas's staff with respect to kind of broadening that even more than what you see in the sponsor substitute. I think that language is flexible with respect to kind of instead of listing specific groups, maybe state and federal entities and other entities. So there could be a couple additional adjustments, but we do appreciate the approach of having a consulting rather than an advisory group.
Okay.
And make a motion, Mr. Chairman.
I'd like to make a motion that we adopt version E as our working document of Senate Bill 246.
Okay. Is there objections? Okay, seeing none. Senator Baguardi, a question?
Thank you. Yes, through the chair, I am just wondering, is on page 3, line 6, the effect on wildlife. So wildlife including fish, the fisheries. Is that what the intent? I just wondered why the term wildlife.
Where are you speaking?
On ECHO, page 3, line 6.
Okay, got it.
If I may, through the chair, Senator McGuire. In the original study, there does make mention of, you know, that obviously when you build a dam project, you have potential impact on fishing, although that is negligible with the Susitna Dam because of the placement of it so far up the river. So that does not seem to be too much of a concern, although there are some issues that remain, whether the warming of the river potentially and a couple other things like that. So those obviously would be looked at, you know. And also there is a wildlife issue because there is some habitat, obviously, as the dam backs up water, it's going to inundate some areas. So that is why it's mentioned, to make sure that we look at that and evaluate that again. So it would be part of the study to make sure we are understanding that impact.
Okay, and could I just follow up, Mr. Terman? So through the chair, I think the committee might want to consider being more specific about fisheries. Is keeping the wildlife in, and even if it's a positive impact or a negligible impact, I would think that's the kind of thing in proving up the ability to do this project, you're going to probably want to have that information available to folks, because certainly that's a concern to people, and if the project is ever going to move forward, I think having a specific discussion of that would be important.
If I may, Mr. Chairman. Senator McGuire, we assumed that would take place. We wanted to keep the bill somewhat at a minimum and give some direction, but we did not want to direct every action that they might take. So, but we know that is, and that's been discussed with people already, that is something that would definitely need to be done. So if we had to add a word like fish to it.
Fish and wildlife.
Yeah, we don't. Okay. Certainly don't have any problem because we know that is something that would definitely need to be done, okay, particularly on the Susitna River. So there's a lot of information on that already existing.
Right. So we have a conceptual amendment on line 6, which project on fish, wildlife, and land use. any objections? Seeing none, it's adopted. Senator Wagner?
I was just going to say, and Senator Thomas said, there is a lot of information already, especially for salmon.
Yeah.
The only fish that make it above that velocity barrier are king salmon, and there are very, very few of them make it up there. So those studies have been done. Matter of fact, I got a map in the office. You want to look at it. Additionally, though, Senator Thomas, maybe I don't know how many acres are they talking about the reservoir consisting of. I haven't. It's been a long time since I had anything to do with this.
Through the chair, Senator Wagner, I can't enter that specifically because there are several different plans for the river that have been over the years. So as they evaluate it, that will be part of what they come up with. The Devil's Canyon is a relatively small footprint. The
right.
Watana upriver project is quite a bit larger, but still minimal in respects to what some inundate. But I would rather not hesitate to guess right now, and I don't know if there's anybody that could tell you that online right at this moment.
Okay, sir, you have anything else to add?
Mr. Chairman, I do not specific to the bill. I could ask for 1 second to just address one issue that you had mentioned last week, and you had asked with respect to kind of our accomplishments and what AEA is all about. And for this entire week, I've been kicking myself and not mentioning one. There have been several things that I know I should have mentioned, but one thing in particular I wanted to mention to this committee is our efforts in alternative energy. And in particular, we've just completed an alternative energy solicitation in partnership with the Denali Commission. This is the first time we've done an alternative energy solicitation. At the same time, we did a fifth energy cost reduction solicitation. But just to give this committee some information with respect to what type of projects are out there or how many, we had 96 proposals that came in requesting $118 million for total project costs of over $1 billion. Of those 96 proposals, 71 are for feasibility analysis of alternative energy projects, and that would be roughly about $12.3 million for the feasibility and pre-construction projects. I just wanted to bring that to the attention of the committee because we do look at objective ways to analyze projects and do feasibility analysis, and this has been a very important part of our work and look forward to doing more of it. I think obviously Sisseton is a much bigger project than something AEA has looked at in obviously for quite a while. But I did want to at least bring that up to the committee's attention. And the energy cost reduction program that we have been doing, the fifth solicitation has been very successful. Of the four solicitations, we've had benefit cost ratios of 2-to-1 for those projects and over $40 million of fuel cost savings, life cycle savings of the projects that have been funded through that. So, thank you for the time to mention that.
Yeah, thank you, Sarah. Questions or comments for Sarah? Okay, next we will go to Mr. Earl Osman, hydro engineer. Hello, Mr. Osman, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Yes, would you put yourself on the record, and we'd be proud to hear from you.
Yes, my name is Earl Osman. I'm testifying on your
Mr. Osman, can you speak up a little bit, maybe into the microphone?
Sure. Some of the things I was going to mention have already been mentioned, but I will repeat them because it's a lot easier than digging them all out. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can. Go ahead, please. And would you just repeat whom you're representing?
Representing this bill that you have before you, and I don't represent anybody but myself.
Okay, good. Continue, please.
Yeah, I want to thank you and Senator Huggins for allowing me to share my knowledge with your committee. I would like to testify on the study of the Sisseton hydro plant that's proposed in the bills currently before you in the Senate, the House. For a brief background, I'm a professional engineer and president of Fuller Consult for the last 21 years. Our firm is in the process of developing 4 megawatts of hydro for MEA system. We have other plants under reconnaissance, design, and permitting. We also sell power to MEA. Many of you know of us. on a committee because we're developing a paradigm shift in technology by developing a DC transmission project that promises to reduce energy costs for our rural communities. A small fraction of my previous hydro experience is I work with the Quorum, Rampart, Snohomish, and Bradley, as well as did reconnaissance work on many other potential hydro plants throughout Alaska. I also worked on TAPS, NPRA, and ANCS prior to joining Polar Consultant. last year, I was approached by some people who wanted an alternative to the MEA coal plant. Although there's more than 50 megawatts of run-of-the-river hydro potential in the Matanuska Valley, as well as wind sites, to be effective, they need to be combined with a peaking system. Hydro is perfect for this. Hydro is what makes the 300 megawatt Columbia River state line wind system feasible. Interestingly enough, for your information, that system sells a wind power for 4 cents a kilowatt hour on a long-term contract. My first thought was a full-size Susitna project, because of its possible cost and environmental opposition, would not be an acceptable candidate. However, a reduced-size Devil's Canyon portion of this project may be economical and would be more acceptable. So I proposed a dam at Devil's Canyon that was one-half the height of the existing proposal to reduce costs. A 50% reduction in height on one of these dams can reduce the volume of concrete utilized to 20% or so. The dam would be equipped with extra turbines to provide peak power, and although the reservoir is smaller, it would have some storage, and if more is needed, it could be augmented by the upper Watana part of the project, and this is the part of the total project. That also could be scaled back if it was necessary. I would like to strongly recommend that Alaska look at renewables as are proposed in these bills. The renewables should include both Susitna and Chacachamna, as they can work together in providing peaking power and will be key in replacement of new gas turbines or coal plant proposed to repower the rail belt. And I also believe that the power from the rail belt system can be shared with rural localities by using DC transmission. Wind or water energy not used is lost forever. However, the fossil fuel that is replaced by renewables can be reserved and used or sold to the people outside of Alaska, like is being done in Norway. The Department of Energy states we have 45,000 megawatts of developable hydro in Alaska. Alaska can be like Norway with 95% of its electricity. This is what you brought up, Senator Thomas. 95% of its electricity being generated by hydro. Nothing matches the cost of paid off hydro. Cost can be so low that it is practical to use the electricity for heat and instead of burning diesel fuel or natural gas. In less than a decade, many of our vehicles will be using electricity from the grid, which will increase the demand on our current generation system. That's moving into the system over a period of time here. The low cost of energy can result in significant replacement of gasoline and diesel fuel, which should be a great benefit to us. Now, what to do and how to do it? I would advise looking at the economics for both the Susitna and Chacachamna, as well as other renewable energy resources. This is similar to what's proposed by Sarah and the AEA group. An initial analysis should be done to determine if any of these projects or a combination appear fruitful. Now, I'm talking about a more modest scope of work to begin with. The work should be done by a group that includes two hydro plant constructors. One should be Norwegian. Those are the best people that you could possibly get. And the second should be from the U.S. It should also include an engineering firm that knows Alaska and our special conditions, such as R&M. In addition, of course, an economist and a report writer is needed. The report should make recommendations on the best course of action. Provided a project appears to be feasible, then more detailed study can then be performed. This is really an economic situation where we have to define what's going to probably be economical and go after that and not just go with the whole world. It needs to be narrowed down and needs to be done by people who know their business. Coopdale likely has the lowest cost power in Alaska. It doesn't seem long ago that I remember its construction. I strongly recommend that for renewables, the longer timeline be considered. I believe that our economic system is skewed toward short-term gratification that results in higher interest rates and should be used for long-term renewable projects.
Yeah, Mr. Ausbing, can we get you to wrap up, please?
Yes. If I had time, I would tell you about exciting things about our neighbor BC is doing and how we can benefit from this experience. And thank you for allowing me to testify.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Osman. Are there any questions or comments from Mr. Osman? Seeing none. Mr. Hemsath and Ms. Walker, do you have any comments or things to add to the conversation thus far?
I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman. Could you repeat the question, please?
Yeah, we have you signed up here to answer questions. I didn't know whether there were any comments that you want to add to the conversation before we move on.
Mr. Chairman, no, just the fiscal note as it's written is organized specifically to initially focus on the specific project as a feasibility and look for fatal flaws in the engineering and cost of power that may prohibit the project from moving ahead. At the bottom of the fiscal note, it indicates that at any time during the course of the project, from the Susitna perspective, that we find that the Susitna Dam project is non-feasible, we will stop all the work on the Susitna and direct efforts elsewhere. And I just say that only in order that there's never a guarantee in a study that the answer you'd like to have is the answer you're going to get, and the study has been organized in this method so that we can get that answer as quickly as we can to put our resources and our attention elsewhere if we need to.
Thank you, Jim. We appreciate that. And this next committee of referral is to finance, where we'll address in more detail the implication of the fiscal note. Bill sponsor, have anything to add?
No, Mr. Chairman, I do not.
Okay, very good. Thank you very much. Anybody else online or in the room that wants to speak to this bill? Okay, with that, will of the committee?
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to go ahead and move Senate Bill 246, Version E, with attached fiscal note and individual recommendations from committee.
Okay. Is there objections? Seeing none. 246 will move from committee to its next committee referral, which is finance. Thank you very much, and we are adjourned.